Hello, listener. Do you think you've got what it takes to be a politician? Even like a local councillor, never mind the head of a state. Let's talk about love. I don't think I've got what it takes. I think I am not tactful enough with my words. I'm not quick enough on my feet. I'm just not sneaky and cunning enough, I think, and not likable enough. So there's probably a lot of different reasons why one wouldn't make a good politician. I think most people probably wouldn't. Most people probably don't want to be politicians. Wanting to be one is probably also a key quality. So the reason I'm banging on about all this is because it's pretty relevant to the book we're covering in our episode this time. The book is Cherries on a Pomegranate Tree by Lee R. The guest on the episode is the book's translator, Dave Haysom. It's an interesting book. It's an interesting chat, if you can believe it. So you've got that to look forward to. But of course, before we get to the interview, you're going to have to endure the news segment, the Trichific News, the translated Chinese fiction news. So there are no less than three items this time in the news. The first one is a reading list. A listicle, as it were. This is on cbbc.org. Now, if you're like me and you grew up in the UK under the auspices of the BBC, you might think CBBC is the children's arm of the British Broadcasting Company or corporation. I forget what the final C in BBC is, but it isn't. It's the China Britain Business, is it Council? Yes, Council. They've got a branch of their organization called Focus, which apparently is the content arm of the China Britain Business Council. So this is a listicle about some very interesting content, if you dare refer to literature as content, which you must never do. The list is by none other than Paul French. I think in a previous episode, a recent one with Michelle Dieter on Bad Kids, she mentioned Mr. French had been working on this, just reading loads and loads of translated, and I think also English language, Chinese lit in various forms. And, well, he's, I don't know, this is at least one place where it's going up. He's produced a reading list article for this CBBC, which is not children's BBC programming. Quite a few familiar names here. The first item on this list is actually a book that's mentioned in this upcoming interview. It's Nothing But the Now by Wen Jun, translated by Dave Haysom. You'll hear Dave actually talk about that book in the coming interview. You'll also see the show guest before him, one of his translations. So the book is Beijing Sprawl by Shu Zichun, jointly translated by Mr. Jeremy Chang and Mr. Eric Abrahamson. There's another Jeremy book a little further down. Oh man, just a whole load of recognizable names and some people I don't recognize as well. So, and indeed books that have not been covered on the show but have appeared on these news segments. So all sorts in there. Check it out. Links in the show notes. That is, by the way, when I say show notes, that means the episode description. I'd assume people know the terminology, but that might be arrogant or presumptuous. Assumptive, is that a word? Presumptuous is a better word than assumptive. So that was could be presumptuous of me to think that you know what I mean by show notes, but that's what it is. It's a text under the episode. There's always links in there. I tend not to look at, for podcasts I listen to, I don't usually look at their show notes. So maybe it's hypocritical for me to try and bully you all into looking at mine, but these links are always there. Okay, second news item. It's a name that actually appeared in that list. So in Paul's list, a not translated book that he stuck in there was Elsewhere, the English language debut by Yang Ge. So I was kind of struggling for news items this week. So I did one of the things I do when that happens. I went onto YouTube, searched for recent videos over 20 minutes long to see if I could find talks or long entries on Chinese lit. And it's a good way to turn up stuff that is going to quite possibly just sit and rack up quite a modest number of views. So this video I'm promoting, sharing, whatever, the one that's made the news, it's posted by the Greenlight Bookstore, and it's been up for 13 days at the time of recording. In that time, it scored 18 views. But that's a shame. We should do something about that, because it's an interview with Yanga promoting, promoting Elsewhere, her book, with another author, one Jinwoo Chong, who is also an author. I don't know so much about Jinwoo. The Woo is spelled W-O-O, which makes me think perhaps he's Korean or Korean diaspora. I don't know. But it's basically just Jinwoo Chong interviewing Yanga. I've not watched it, but it's an hour long. It's on YouTube. It looks like a recorded Zoom call, I think. Yeah, it's a Zoom recording. So it's a very sort of pandemic style book event. But you know what? That's great. It's good that we have the means to put on these virtual shareable events so easily, provided at least someone's got the paid Zoom subscription to extend the meeting over 20 minutes. Gosh, I'm not being concise this time, but I'm feeling talkative, so maybe it's good that I'm not being concise. Okay, third news item. Now, this one is... It's not really news. This is just me. So, yeah, let's say news segment is over, and now this is just the housekeeping, shall we say. So, the show, as I've said, I think, in every episode for the last few episodes, is approaching an end. Probably not the end, but an end, a hiatus, basically. Episode 100... I'm going to go off and do other things with my free time, possibly for quite a while. So I'm trying to think of something fun things to do. There are quite a lot of fun standard episodes on their way. The plan is to do one or two party episodes near the end. I need to start maybe getting the ball rolling on those, actually. But I was also thinking perhaps an offline party could be fun. Of course, this is a show with a very small... pretty small number of listeners because it's so niche and it's not very regular. So, and the other thing about the listenership is you guys are scattered all over the world and I'm on a little island in Europe called Britain, I suppose. I was about to say England. England is not an island. England is one part of the British, big British island. So I'm in Manchester. If I was to hold like a wrap up ending the podcast gathering, it would be somewhere in central Manchester, I think. If you're at all interested in coming, let me know. If it seems like more than like two people seem keen, maybe I'll try and organize it. I don't think it would be an event. I think it would literally just be hanging out, if that's something you'd like to do. So yeah, I don't have any plan to make an event page for it unless a lot of people seem interested. We'll see. There's going to be a lot of time between then and now and that potentially happening, because I don't bring these episodes out all that quickly, as I'm sure you know. The other thing about potentially something fun to end the show on, and I've not been very consistent about this, is if you'd like to email in any thoughts you've had that you'd want to have read out at the end of the show, I'm going to stick my email, well, the show's email address in the show notes. It's just the full show's name with no spaces with @outlook.com on the end. So it's really long. The Translated Chinese Fiction Podcast @outlook.com. If you want to share anything to go on like a mailbag section near the end of the whole series, you can do so. You can also, if you just send it in via whatever social media channel, I can archive it for that as well. Again, if I get like two, I don't think I'll do a mailbag, or maybe I will. If I get more than one, maybe I will. I think there's a solid odds we'll get none. If so, at least I gave it a crack. Okay, that's the news and the housekeeping done, and not a minute too soon. Let's advance to my interview with Mr. Dave Haysom about Mr. Li R's Cherries on a Pomegranate Tree. On the show, we have Dave Haysom here to talk about Cherries on a Pomegranate Tree by Li R. Really exciting to have you here, Dave. I'm having a little bit of deja vu. We've sort of done this before on the Sinuous Books Book Club, but back for round two to talk about this novel. Excellent. You've not been on this show before, so what should listeners know about you and your connection to Chinese lit before we steamroll ahead?
Sure. Very happy to be here on the podcast. I guess I'll start by saying I'm a long-term resident of Beijing. I've been living in Beijing since 2007. And I started translating in about 2012, after I'd been learning and reading Chinese for a little while. Initially, I started posting just on my own blog, which is spittingdog.net. And then After I started to publish elsewhere, I eventually also became the joint managing editor of Pathlight, which is a literary journal of Chinese literature and translation. And I was in charge of commissioning and editing translations there for a few years. I also contributed to Paper Republic, which is a website I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with, and helped organize the Read Paper Republic project, which is an initiative we launched to publish one translation every week for a year. Recently, I've translated a few novels, as well as the book we're discussing today. I also have a short story collection by Wen Zhen, which came out earlier this year. I co-translated a poetry collection by Yu Yo-Yo, which I co-translated with A.K. Blakemore a couple of years ago. And I'm not so actively involved in editing anymore, but I'm still translating when I get the opportunity.
What's that short story collection called?
It's called Nothing But the Now. Is the English title. The original Chinese title is just Seven, Qi, but that's the name that the publishers chose for the English version.
Yeah, I suppose that one's taken by the David Fincher film in English.
Yep.
Yep.
No heads in boxes in these stories.
Poetry does tend to be a bit less bloody than David Fincher films. Okay, so that's yourself. Thanks for introducing yourself. Now we'll introduce the author, Li Ar. So who is he? And what does he write?
So he's an author from Henan. He was born in 1966. And in China, authors are generally kind of bracketed by the decade of their birth. So he's in the 1960 generation, which puts him a little bit behind some of the big names like Mo Yan and Yan Liang Ke and Liu Junyun. He's the same generation as Bi Fei Yu and Ge Fei. And I would say is kind of about the same level as them in terms of his status and his reputation, although he's not as prolific as some of the other authors that I've mentioned. He's only published three novels in his career, although he has also written a lot of short stories, novellas, essays. The first of those is Coloratura, which was published in Chinese in 2001. The Chinese title is Hua Chang, and that was translated by Jeremy Tian into English. That's a kind of historical fiction novel set against the Chinese Civil War, but it's also kind of a mosaic of different sources and different voices, and it's kind of an exploration of whether there can be any objective historical truth. So that was his first novel, and then Cherries on a Pomegranate Tree was published in 2004. It's been adapted into a film. It's done quite well in German translation. It was translates into German by Thekla Chabi, not too many years after it was originally published in Chinese. Yeah. And then more recently, he published in 2018 his third and lengthiest novel, Ying Wu Xiong. That one has not been translated yet, but it's a sort of academic novel about professors and the things that they get up to. I haven't read it. I've been actually kind of avoiding it because it's so long, and I don't want to get sort of sucked into this enormous, like, two-volume thing that he spent more than a decade writing. Oh. But as I say, he's also done short stories as well. He's done some sort of more experimental stuff. We had a short story of his in Pathlight in 2015 called Where Are You, which was translated by Josh Dyer, and that's narrated from the perspective of a fetus in the womb of a drug addicted mother, and that's a very sort of surreal, like carnivalesque, experimental kind of short story. But I would say his main modes are kind of rural stories and like academia, and a little bit of historical fiction as well.
Oh, I apologize for the next sentence, but I'm pleased that you mentioned fetuses because they do relate to the plot of Cherries on a Pomegranate Tree. So what's it all about? How do fetuses factor in? And what happens across the plot?
So it's set in a village in Henan, and it focuses around the main character, the protagonist of the book, whose name is Kong Fanhua. She is the village head, and she is the only woman who has any kind of power in the county, and the local village elections are coming up soon, and that's what sort of powers the plot, is her need to keep a wrap on things, keep everything under control so that she can maximize her chances of being re-elected. So that village level elections is the background to everything that happens in the book. And then she has to maneuver through these various challenges. She has political issues to deal with. There's a rivalry with the nearby local village. There's various machinations involving a paper factory and the funding. She's courting investment from America, trying to get funds for the village. There are personal issues to deal with. There's all the various ambitious other council members who are kind of jockeying for position. There are threats from the wider community, from her family. She's in conflict with her parents, who would like her to have another child. Her husband, who's working away from home and has just come back. But the primary inciting incident of the story is when a local woman who has already had two children gets pregnant for a third time, and that would violate the family planning one-child policy. That would be something that means Fanhua would have no chance of retaining her job. And so that's the thing that she has to deal with. So she has to first figure out how it happened, because there are various checks and measures in place to make sure it doesn't. And then she has to track her down when this woman disappears. So that woman runs off, and Fanhua has to try and find where she's gone.
Yeah. So there's a couple like really interesting political things. I'm aware probably most people listening know this stuff, but for the benefit of anyone who doesn't, this is literally a book about an election in China. It's the village election, which, if I understand correctly, is the only level of the Chinese political system where like ordinary citizens get to vote to pick their leaders, and you get to see that in this novel, which strikes, I don't know if there's other novels like that in available in Chinese, but at least in translation seems quite special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a sort of unique feature of the village level of the political system. And I think it's maybe been restrained a little bit in more recent years. I think the amount of choice that is available has been cut down slightly. But yeah, in the early 2000s, when this book is set, you do have elections, and you do have people with the freedom to choose their village head, their village candidate.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot myself. I remember seeing reports, I think around the time I was living in China, about, I think first there was a BBC report on a woman who was running as an independent rather than as like under the Communist Party. And I think she was technically allowed to do it, but she was getting like sort of penned into her home by anonymous guy, ununiformed heavies. And I think there was a formal law a little further down the line saying, like, I think everyone in the village elections has to be party or party approved or something. But like you said, this is all happening quite a long time before that. So when Liar's writing it, it's a more democratic, fully democratic vote at that level. So that was one thing. And then the other big political topic, I guess, is, and it's right there on the cover of this edition in translation, there's a little a fetus again inside a pomegranate. It's the one child policy, which has moved in the opposite direction. That's loosened since the book came out. But I think I don't know, at some point I think it was when the one child policy became a two child policy, I was reading articles about it, and I learned that the one child policy was, at least when, I don't know, in more recent history, it was never quite flat. It wasn't like a flat level one child policy. Some people might be allowed two, some might be allowed three. It could depend on your region, if you're an ethnic minority. There was lots of other factors. That's my understanding. But from what I remember having read this book, because admittedly I read it a while ago, the offending character, it's not her first time having a baby she's not supposed to have. Is that right?
Yeah. So as you say, it sort of varies. Varies depending on the individual family. It varies a little bit depending on which ethnic group you belong to and which place you're in. The woman who gets pregnant in this story already has two children who are both girls. So having had one child who was a girl, she was allowed to have a second. Right. That's kind of like a sort of kind of permissible, but that's not an option for Kong Fanhua, who is the protagonist of the story, because she is the village leader. And so she has to be like, very firmly within the lines. Mm-hmm. She can't be in that kind of gray area of, though she's had a daughter, it would, if she wasn't a village official, it would be kind of okay for her to have a second child, which is what her parents are pressuring her to do. But because she has to maintain this squeaky clean image, she doesn't have that option of getting pregnant for a second time. But Yao Shua, the woman who disappears, is pregnant for the third time, which is definitely not okay.
Right, yeah. Kong Fan Hua, I was having a look at, I've done this for the last few episodes, but I was having a look at Goodreads reviews of the book. And one of the reviews for this one referred to Kong Fan Hua as the hero of the book, the heroine. And I thought that was interesting because she's definitely the main character. We're following her struggles. And in my view, reading it, she does a few, not despicable things, but she's maybe immoral. She struck me as a little bit immoral, amoral, not immoral. But then there's other points where she does seem to be firmly principled, whether it's for practical reasons, because she knows she has to set an example, or it's because she really does have these sorts of rules that guide her that she needs to set an example. I realized it sounded like I was coming to a point there. I think I already reached my point. But yeah, she's interesting in that regard, that she's not a corrupt local leader, really. Some of her means to her ends are a bit dubious, but if there are corrupt people in the local government in the story, she doesn't strike me as one of them, although perhaps I'm just not remembering every aspect of the book. Or perhaps through the course of the novel, we see her thinking about this. I remember there's a factory that I seem to recall she was formulating devious plans for.
Yeah, I think, as you say, there are these two political components to the book, but I wouldn't really describe it as like a political novel as such, because I don't think it's that interested in kind of interrogating those policies. They're just facts of life and features of the setting. And I think Leah is more interested in exploring the characters, and specifically the character of Fan Hua, and how it feels for her to have this internal conflict and external conflicts with the other villagers. But yeah, I think she is kind of contrasted with more corrupt individuals. She comes into contact with superiors, with officials at other villages. We see she makes a trip to another village where they are enforcing the one-child policy much more harshly and being, you know, far more ruthless than she is. So I think that's kind of included to make us feel a little bit of sympathy for her, even though she doesn't really fret too much about whether what she's doing is right. She's very practical and doing what needs to be done.
I've read in various places that the way the multi-leveled system of Chinese government works is that the central government issues the sorts of goals or the policies in a broad form, and then they sort of leave the provincial governments and the branches of the provincial governments to pursue them in the best way they see fit. So I guess that wouldn't necessarily have been the policy under Mao, but in the sort of, I don't know when this shape began, but the era of China that we live in and that this book is set in is following that thing of you're given a task. It might be a quite draconian policy like the one-child policy, and the thing you're judged on is not how you implement it, but the results you produce. It's how good the outcomes are. So I think you can sort of see it that playing out in the book, because Fan Hua is under a lot of pressure to make sure she keeps everyone in sight to win votes to stay the leader, competition from the neighboring villages, who I guess would be trying to get better stats than her in the way they pursued their policies. And then also there's the pressure from above not to venture outside the rules, but also to produce big numbers as well.
Yeah, I mean, you see that process of sort of directives filtering down from the very beginning of the book, where she sort of comes back from a meeting with the county head, and the county head has said, like, this is our approach. We're having absolute zero tolerance for pregnancies outside of the one-child policy plan. And she sort of reports that back to the rest of the villages when she returns to the council. So So yeah, things kind of filter down from the top and are relayed to the relevant people.
I realized I don't have any specific questions about the characters. We have been talking quite a bit about Kong Fun Hua. Before I start asking you a whole different set of questions, do you want to highlight any of the other characters?
There's a lot of characters in the book. That's something we can talk about later on, maybe. And I think they're all fairly well drawn. I think the other interesting characters, I mentioned that Fan Hua is kind of the only woman who has a position of power, but she does have her protege, Xiao Hong, who is also a woman and who sort of comes in to help her at various points in the story, who she is kind of preparing to maybe be her successor one day. I think she's a pretty interesting character who sort of is there in the background and then comes in and out of the story at crucial moments. I also like her relationship with her husband, Bianjin, who's come back from working in a factory and is sort of behaving weirdly, and she has to try and figure out what's going on with him. He's keeping back something. He's hiding a secret from her. But the relationship between them, I think, is quite nicely written. It feels quite like an authentic relationship where they're kind of teasing each other and undermining each other, but in an affectionate kind of way. It could easily be more of a sort of caricature where, you know, she is nagging him or he is just a kind of useless husband. But I think they're both more three-dimensional than that in terms of their relationship with each other. So yeah, Xiao Hong and Dianjin are two characters that I enjoy when they are showing up throughout the book.
Yeah, and I think as a reader, you're also finding Dianjun to be a bit of a head scratcher. It's not just his wife that's puzzled. He has a fixation on camels that I remember, but cannot remember what on earth that was about. Just that he's got a fixation on camels, and that made it onto the hook line on the blurb of the book. Americans, babies, and ... camels.
Yeah.
I feel I don't want to elaborate on that. I just want to leave that dangling for listeners.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate. No, you have the thematic interest in childbirth and pregnancy is kind of refracted through the stories in these other elements. So you also have there's kind of like a breeding industry in the village and a character called Qinglin who is breeding wolves. And yeah, Dianjin thinks breeding camels, that's the solution. That's what they need to be getting into. The camel business is where it's at.
Yeah, there's a wolf in the book. I find that very curious. I was wondering if that was, would that realistically have been like a half wolf dog thing or just a wolf wolf? And also, is that something is that something he's seen? Is it something he would bother to make especially realistic? But yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of people. And I forgot to mention, yeah, I had it in my head and then it slipped away talking about policies that Fan Hua is the only female leader in the different levels of local government. So a lot of her interactions with the other leaders are not just interactions with other leaders, they are sort of by necessity interactions with men who are, you know, who make up the system. Listeners, if you've ever looked at pictures of the Chinese government having their big meetings, it's hard not, well, maybe you wouldn't notice, but once you have the thought, where's the woman? I feel like you can't unthink it. They're almost non-existent. So that was an interesting aspect of the book. And I felt that you did see quite a spectrum of different types of guy. Some of them treat Fan Hua just like a normal person, like they would any other leader. Others are rather, they make sorts of, they seem like sleazy guys. And even if they're not directly sleazy to Fan Hua, they make some sorts of inappropriate remarks that maybe they think are funny, but things they wouldn't be saying if Fan Hua was a man. And yeah, I found that to be an interesting aspect of the book. Don't think I've got any deep analysis of it, but it's definitely there.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that the title alludes to, Cherries on the Pomegranate Tree. It's that particular image is referred to in this various kind of upside down songs that are cited throughout the book, where you have the sort of narration of things that are going on in the village in this sing-song nursery rhyme format. And it's sort of also describing like things that are wrong, things that are inside out, things that are unnatural, like a mouse chasing a cat and a cherry growing on a pomegranate tree. And the implied inference is a woman in power, right? A woman in power is also against the natural order of things as it appears to the men of the village.
Lovely, lovely men. Oh, is it set in Hunan, the same as Liara's home province, or is the province unspecified?
I don't think it's directly specified in the book, but my understanding is yes, it is meant to be set in Hunan.
Fun fact, I may have said this the last time we talked about this book, I don't remember, but the first place I live in China was like the capital town of a county, Duqing, which is the nearest Wukang town, Duqing County, close to Muganshan. And I think it was mayor or the head, whatever, the head of the county government was a woman. And she had done something perhaps somewhat Fanhua-ish. I believe the story goes that before she was in power in Duqing, there was quite a lot of brothels running in this town, Wukang, or in the county. And after she took the reins, she did a big drive against them, and so I'm told they were all gone. Don't know if she was especially Fanhua-ish beyond that, but yeah, I think that was the first local, possibly the only bigwig I ever sort of was in any proximity to, and it was a woman. So don't know if I never mentioned that on this podcast before. I have now. The box is ticked. I want to ask you about the mood and the style, because we've talked about the characters and we've talked about the plot, but what are the vibes? So you've established it's not like driving into the ideologies of rural China, and it's more about just sort of the characters, but like what's the mood? Is it setting you up an easy one here? Is it a comedy? Is it a lighthearted comedy, subtle comedy, black comedy? Or is it more of a drama, melodrama? I don't really think it's a thriller, but is it a thriller?
Yeah, in terms of tone, it's definitely leaning towards the comedic side, which I think might surprise people based on the description of the subject matter. But yeah, it's mostly comedic. At times, it leans into farce, I think. There are serious moments, so I think dark humor would be an appropriate descriptor for certain episodes. Structurally, I think it has some similarities with a detective story, and the sort of investigation of how this illegal pregnancy happened and where the woman has gone, and then all of the sort of political machinations going on in the background, I think are also mostly approached through the lens of comedy, but with a sort of serious element in the background as well.
Yeah, it's definitely got that thing from a good detective. Well, I'm saying show because I've probably watched more detective shows than I've seen in films than I've read books. But that thing of like visiting someone else's room in someone else's building you've never met before, and then trying to get answers out of them, and all of their answers are like these really evasive, only partially helpful answers, and then gradually you get somewhere closer to the truth, but the truth might not be something that you like. It's definitely got that sort of angle to it. I thought that the comedy, there was times in the book when I was reading it where I had to sort of remind myself it was a comedy, because the delivery was so sort of dry or straight-faced that I had to stop and think, wait, what? Think about the situation that's actually happening here. This is completely insane. Like I remember there's a scene where the people of our village and the neighboring village are having like a brawl in a field or something. And reading it, I had to stop and think, wait, how on earth did it come to this? How are people acting as if this is normal? This is completely loony.
Yeah. There's occasional moments of violence like that in the book. But as you say, it's definitely not a thriller in any sense of the word.
Yeah. How about the style of writing?
I think I would describe it as a dialogue led. I think the dialogue is one of the strengths of the book. I think the characters have distinctive voices and speak in a way that feels quite natural to me. At least that was what I was trying to convey in the translation. So yeah, led by the dialogue. I think the dialogue is maybe the most, is more important than the kind of description of the setting or the characters, which is more functional. We don't get much, we're pretty much focused tightly on Fanhua's perspective. So we get some focalization of how she's feeling, what she's thinking, but it's more focused on action and dialogue and externalities than it is kind of going deep into any character's internal feelings.
Yeah, I've heard it said, and possibly I've repeated on the show, that one criticism of modern Chinese lit is that it doesn't tend to do that. You don't tend to get extended sorts of trips inside characters' heads very often.
Yeah, I think it is something that in novels written in the more Western tradition, you have a more of a sense of continuity, maybe, of that, how that sort of developed out of modernism, and how, yeah, I think the continuity of the tradition is a little bit different if you compare writers writing in English compared to writers writing in Chinese.
Sure. The idea that dipping into characters' internal monologues or just into their thoughts, we shouldn't trick ourselves into thinking that that's a God-given way to write good fiction or a good novel, and that that's the formula. You're not doing a proper job if you're not following. Like you said, that's an emergence from a particular moment in lit in Europe or in English, and it, I guess, it works nicely, makes for quite related. It's funny that it starts off in like these ramble, the slightly experimental train of thought, Virginia Woolf style, weird experimental stuff, and then you end up with a very practical way to write an engaging commercial sort of mass paperback sort of thing, or to write deep literature, getting into the weird caverns of people's minds. But, and there goes my train of thought. I can't think how to close that point. But yeah, it's worth pointing out, like you said, that the thing we're so used to is not as maybe as fundamental as, say, dialogue or basic descriptions of the place. Books can take a lot of forms, and I'm repeating myself now, but the use of going into characters' heads, I guess it's in continued use because it works, but it's not always been there.
Yeah, it's one of the sort of the features that we have in like our mental checklist of what good fiction looks like, or particularly what literary fiction looks like, which is, you know, a genre of its own. But as you say, it's
historically contingent. Those are the words I was reaching for.
Yeah, there are plenty of Chinese writers who can do it, but it's Chinese fiction has its own traditions and its own habits.
Yeah, okay. Next thing I wanted to ask you was about any favorite moments or episodes, because I think I gave you a chance to highlight characters. You talked about style. Oh, actually, I realized I've just skipped a question. Time and place. Yeah, I'll do that one first. So,
okay.
Start again. Okay, we've maybe touched a bit on the setting and the time, but I want to dig into it a bit more. So just how important is the time and the place that the story's happening?
Yeah, so for the reasons I think we've mentioned already, the time of the early 2000s is a pretty important historical moment in that the one-child policy is operating in the way that it is. You also have the local village elections operating in the way that they are. I think if you move back or forward a decade or two, those two factors would be very different, and the story would unfold in a different way. I think many of the characters wouldn't change too much, but the details of the setting would certainly have some variation. And in terms of the place, I think it's a story that has to happen in rural China. And one of the features that is maybe specific to the part of China that they're in is the connection to Confucius and the Confucian history, which is something that comes up again and again in the book. The idea that everyone in the village can kind of trace their ancestry back to Confucius, you know, through some degree of connection, descent. So the idea that there are these visions is in that's referred to a few times throughout the book. You also get these flashbacks to to the 1960s and the Cultural Revolution, when they're, you know, deciding whether to burn down the Confucian Temple, and no one wants to be the one who actually sets fire to the thing, but eventually it happens. So I'd say those are some of the details that make the specific place more important to the story.
You think Li R is bringing in the sort of shadow of Confucius to comment on the question of like leadership that Kong Fenghua is trying to, her as a leader and how she's trying to embody being a leader, or do you think it's about the sorts of top down, or no, what am I trying to say, the sort of paternalistic rules set out about what sort of families you're allowed to have, what shape your family should be? Is that why Confucius is in there, or is it more just like, gosh, look how earthy these and connected to the history these rural people are? What do you think? Because he chose to do that. It's not just coincidental, I guess.
Yeah, I think it is bringing in that additional dimension in terms of what power can look like and how it can operate. But I'm not sure if he's using it to make a specific point rather than just maybe adding another layer into the story. But yeah, certainly that kind of patriarchal authority, the idea of power kind of radiating out from one central authority, I think is relevant to the book and expands the book, but definitely is in the background rather than in the foreground.
I wonder if there's an element of comedy there as well, because it's the mighty figure of Confucius and his descendants are like these petty bureaucrats for a communist party, for the world's biggest communist party. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there's various streaks of irony throughout the book, and there's certainly some there.
Yeah, because I don't think Confucius would have been a communist. Doesn't seem likely. Although I did ask you this first time around at the Sinos Books event, but the Kong in Kong Fanhua's name, that's the same Kong from Kongzi Confucius. So like he's right there in her name.
Right. And all of the, not only the surnames, but also the first names, the given names of the characters also, this is something I hadn't realized until actually after I translated the book and I mentioned it to Liar, and he pointed out, so all the characters whose name begin with Xiang, like that tells you that they are the 75th generation of Confucian descent, and all the characters whose name begin with Fan are the 74th generation, and all the characters whose name begin with Qing are the 73rd generation. So you have this extra information being encoded into their names, which I'm not sure if all Chinese readers would pick up on. I think some Chinese readers would pick up on, but certainly isn't something that is apparent to someone reading it in English. It's just something that makes the characters' names confusingly similar.
Yeah, is there any significance to like the character that's used for Xiang? Is that indicating a year in the calendar or something? Or
I'm not sure.
Not sure. Okay, fair enough. Well, presumably the R has he's written out a massive family tree and names of characters for dozens of generations. Presumably that's how that works.
I'm not sure. Like there are a couple of moments in the story when I think he actually got his own character names muddled up, and there's a couple of points where I checked with him, and I think we corrected the mistakes in the English version, because even he got confused about which character was which occasionally.
It's all joy for you, I guess.
Yeah.
Because at least in the city, you're not obliged to know everyone, but in a village, you really ought to, but that makes it harder. Okay, so I've asked you about the place and the time. This would be when Jiang Zemin is the leader. Is that right?
Yes.
Right. No real comment on that, but for all the Jiang Zemin fans out there, this is a Jiang Zemin book. Did he write it? Is the setting in time long before the time of writing, or are they about the same?
No, it's early 2000s. I think there are like a few details in the book that can narrow it down slightly. But yeah, early 2000s.
But is that when he wrote it as well?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Cool. Right. No more time and place questions for you. Instead, I'll ask if you've got any favorite moments in the novel. Anything made you laugh or struck you as being memorable, incredible, whatever.
There's lots of sort of smaller moments that I like. There's things like sort of inconsequential interludes, like there's a car driving down the road and a bunch of geese that are passing by just like attack the car, and it's totally inconsequential. It doesn't have any relation to the story. It's just an entertaining moment that I enjoy for the comedy of that moment, but also just because the book has room for these little interludes that don't have to be significant in terms of the character development or the plot. That's one moment I like, just as a kind of throwaway moment. I also like early on in the book the moment when Fanhua discovers about the pregnancy, about Xue'er's pregnancy, from another local woman called Pei Zhen, and she's sort of there talking to Pei Zhen with another council member, Meng Qingshu, who is the person who's meant to be responsible for family planning. Like, that is his job. But you have this very kind of awkward conversation where Pei Zhen is refusing to kind of directly reveal what she knows about, or how she knows that Xue'er is pregnant. And it's because they've been sharing the same toilet, and Pei Zhen has noticed that Xue'er has not had to use any sanitary pads recently, and has therefore concluded that she is pregnant. But like, no one, both Pei Zhen and Qingxu both kind of go around this topic and avoid talking about it in this very evasive way, while Fanhao is just like trying to force them to talk straight. And I think that's a pretty, it's a significant moment in the plot, and it's also an entertaining moment in the book.
I wish I could pull out the goose incident. I've got the book next to me. If I knew that was the funniest bit in the whole book for me, and it was simple. It's as simple as, like, what was it? A person stuck in traffic, they honk their horn at the geese, and the geese decide, right, you're having it now, and they attack the car or something. Is that it? Yeah, that really tickled me. I don't know why. Revenge of the animals in the Chinese countryside. Okay. Right, now I'm going to ask you about stuff for translators, since you are the translator. Did the book present any particular translation challenges?
Yeah, I think we've mentioned a couple of them. The recurring upside down sing-song rhymes were something that I felt should be in some form of verse, because they need to stand out from the prose of the book. They need to be different. So I did want to put them into poetic meter and make them rhyme, which is not something I normally do when I'm translating poetry, but they're not really poems, they're something else. And I think it helped differentiate them from the rest of the book. So it took a bit of time to kind of figure out a way to make them work in a particular meter and with a rhyme scheme, but also still communicate the same meaning as the original, and not feel too forced and too artificial. So that was one challenge, was those details. And more broadly, the humor of the book. I think some of it in terms of when it comes through Fanhua's perspective and the way that she's looking at things, I think that translates fairly easily. But there's also, a variety of puns and wordplay. You have like bilingual puns based on characters who are trying to learn English and their imperfect attempts to speak English. And so all of those were quite tricky to translate. Those were some of the parts that in my translation were still sort of left highlighted until the very end, because I had to keep going back and tweak them and rework them and figure out how I could make them work in English but not sound too forced and too like they were trying too hard.
Yeah, that was an element of the book that amused me quite a lot as well. There's like a fictional book within the book, some kind of a guide to learning English, and yeah, some of the characters, some of the things they come out with when they're trying to produce English, I can't remember examples, but yeah, it was kind of pleasingly surreal. I was going to say as well that something I thought about saying when we're talking about the setting in time and what it sort of means for the book. The story feels quite analog, because people are passing around physical books to learn English. They're not learning it on their phones or whatever. And Fanhua isn't doing all her investigations by WeChat or something. doesn't I don't know how connected to the internet the average village would have been just after the millennium in China, but that's something that, I mean, like you said, a lot of it doesn't feel like it would be very different if you were to set it today. Although, who's to say? I've never been a Chinese villager, never spent much time in Chinese villages. But yeah, the lack of the internet and digital technology felt not noticeable, but I think it sort of dictated the feel of the book a little bit. And also, since you were talking a bit about the rhymes, and I have the book in front of me, one of the rhymes is right on the back cover. So I'll just read that. It says, upside down, inside out, a pomegranate tree where cherries sprout. So it's like you were saying, it's got the sort of sing-song feel, which seems about right. Because I have read a few times translations, particularly older ones. I think the translation of Dream of the Red Chamber I read, which is not one of the most, it's not, I think it was the Jolly translation. So if any descendants of Jolly are listening, I'm sorry, but the poems in that I think were re were twisted a bit to make them rhyme, and I don't remember it being very good. I remember it being a bit painful, but these ones, yeah, the rhymes are like, a lot of the time it's a kid reciting the rhyme, so it's like it's perfect.
Yeah, I mean, rhyme in Chinese is not the same as rhyme in English. You know, every language has its own way that rhyme works, and rhyming is much easier in Chinese because you have a more limited set of phonetic sounds, but also more complicated in some ways because you have tones. So yeah, like we were talking about in terms of vocalization, rhyming is also its own tradition, and squashing it into the English forms doesn't always work well.
Another question. This is maybe more of a business question, but it might be interesting for you as a translator. And I've this podcast sprung out of me doing a publishing master's, so I always find this stuff interesting. Do you think this novel is an easy sell for Western readers, in your opinion? Or would it take a little bit of clever marketing or even just chatting with a friend to get them to pick this book up against all the other ones competing for their attention?
I think yes, because of the strong protagonist. I think Fan Hui is quite a engaging protagonist, and I think that's something that a lot of West readers are looking for. I think strong characters more broadly is something that people look for, and the sense of humor, to the extent that it does come through in the translation, I think is also something that makes it accessible and makes it an easier sell. One of the things that makes it more inaccessible, I guess, is the character names. That's something we've already mentioned, that you have a lot of characters, and for the most part, their names in the translation are transliterated. So Fan Hua is just the sound of her name taken from Chinese and into English. In Chinese, those names are more memorable because they communicate some meaning. They have some semantic content.
Right.
But in English, they're just sounds. So there's like, you don't have anything you can kind of hang your memory of the character onto through the name. So that really changes the experience of reading because you have to exert that extra mental effort just to keep track of everyone. And that's something that kind of gets in the way of it being the kind of light, easy read that it could otherwise be. And also the fact that the one child policy is, as we said at the top of the podcast, now a thing of the past, and the policy is now swung in completely the opposite direction. The fact that that makes it less relevant to contemporary China, I think, is maybe something that people might think is a reason not to read the book because it's not so relevant today. But I think that's only true if you kind of approach fiction with quite a instrumental, utilitarian kind of mindset, where you're thinking, you know, what is this book going to teach me about contemporary China? Which I think is not the only way to read fiction. And the policy has swung in the opposite direction, but the policy is still telling women what to do with their bodies and trying to control childbirth. So it's reversed, but it hasn't disappeared.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, that's an interesting point. I do think I definitely agree with you that there's, while, you know, a fiction book maybe, there's some argument that reading in translation is a good way to get a sense of what lives are like or what social questions are boiling in other parts of the world. I do think there's sort of a special place in hell for people that write blurbs or marketing for fiction books as if they're nonfiction or as if they're the key. So, you know, like this is the key to understand communist China or something. It might help sell that one book, but I feel like it doesn't really benefit the literature and translation mission as a whole, because it sort of concentrates all the interest onto like what is probably the most obvious and reductive topic, I think, because yeah, you'll miss all the fine character details and the literary qualities of the author's work for these political questions that were already on your mind to begin with, you know?
Every author is just writing as an individual rather than as, you know, a representative of China at this moment in time or China in this particular location.
For sure. Yeah. I think that's all for my quiz the translator style questions. I can take us to the miscellaneous section now. So the first miscellaneous question is a word of the day. So if you were to think of a Chinese word, any word that sort of captures the spirit of the book, does one spring to mind?
I'm not sure if it necessarily captures the spirit of the book, but I would suggest go dog as the word for the day, because as we mentioned, you do have these dogs and these wolves in the story as literal animals who are present. But there's also these like a few sort of figure of speeches that recur throughout the book that use the word go in a couple of ways, and figuring out how to translate them was one of the challenges of the book. So one of them is like a few times characters say "piani should go," which I wasn't really sure how to translate at first, because it literally means like "deceive you is dog," and I sort of wasn't really sure until eventually I sort of spoke to some other people, and once you sort of get the sense of the from the context and the way the intonation works, it's kind of like to cheat you would be a dog, right? Or like only a dog would try and cheat you, or I'm a dog if I trick you. So it's something that characters say when they're like trying to communicate that they're being honest, right? Like I wouldn't trick you, you know. So I translated that as call me a cur if I'm lying,
All
because
right.
I thought the sort of the alliteration of call me and cur and the rhythm gives it a slightly sort of idiomatic flavor, even though it's not actually an English idiom. So there's that dog, and there's also a more frequent dog idiom, which is golrüde, which is literally like screwed by a dog, which is kind of used pretty much like we might use like goddamn in English. It's something that characters say all the time, but because you have not only this figurative use of the phrase, but it's also used in a literal sense as well. So when the characters are talking about the wolf farm, like one of them says, you know, he's set up this like golrüde peijongdan, which is like a, you know, he's set up this goddamn stud farm, and he replies in Chinese, "Pusha golrüde, shiru golda." So like it's not screwed by a dog, it's like screwing dogs, which doesn't quite work in it's hard to translate into English because it kind of occasionally overlaps with like son of a bitch, but it doesn't really that's not really how we use son of a bitch in English, or only it over only overlaps a little bit. So what I changed that to into English is Qinglin says not just sons of bitches, daughters of bitches too. And I think that's doing the same thing of like taking a figurative phrase and making it into something more literal. But the exact equivalent doesn't quite work in English. So yeah, go is my suggestion for a word of the day.
Perfect. And it's not just because your blog is the spitting dog.
Nope, not at
Not
all.
biased.
Total
Okay.
coincidence.
Good stuff. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned, was it Pian for like a scam or something? That is a strange coincidence because I did not know that word until I think yesterday or 2 days before. I was trying to come up with the I on like the episode arts that I make for, well, the YouTube thumbnails essentially, but also the image I make for each episode. I put a big Chinese word, really just for YouTube to catch people's eye. I don't know if it works. And the book in question was Running Through Beijing by Xu Zicheng. And I wanted a word that meant hustle, as in like a hustler in Chinese. And I got really stuck because it seemed like I couldn't, I was working with Google Translate and then my dictionary app and then like dictionary websites and couldn't really find anything. Asked the fans for help on social media. Still feel like the one I arrived at was an approximation. But one of the first ones I stumbled across was Pianza or Pianza. So like a thief, a scammer. But then I realized that's not really a hustler because a hustler isn't necessarily a scammer. They might be. But yeah, so while I've got you on the line, do you think there's a word for like hustle or hustler? Because this is really
Not,
bothering me.
yeah, I mean, not one that springs to mind,
I think
because
Zheng Chu
yeah,
was the one I got.
it is a word that has kind of been given a new meaning in more recent years, I guess, right? It's
Yeah.
something
Because, yeah,
that
if you put it into a dictionary, it'll often just give you like move quickly or something, which isn't right either.
yeah, I'm not sure about that one.
Yeah. Sorry to throw that one on you. It's been haunting me. Anyway, next miscellaneous question. It's the music question. So if you could, if you were, you said this one's already been adapted. So I can't really say if it were to be adapted to a film, what would you soundtrack it with? But I don't know, let's say we're making the radio drama. What music would you set the radio drama to?
Again, my answer is a slightly different interpretation of the question. I picked a song that comes to my mind from the book. There's a particular song that comes up a few times called Shei Pu Shuo An Jia Xiang Hao, which I translated as Who Says My Village Ain't Lovely, which has the same rhythm as Oh What a Beautiful Morning. So that song is what sort of comes to my mind when I read that line, and it's a song that is like played on the loudspeakers throughout the village. So as a kind of rural positive song that I can imagine being played perhaps over the top of things that are not so positive and not so beautiful as the tone of the song would suggest, I would pick Oh What a Beautiful Morning.
And it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way. All the cattle are standing like statues. All the cattle are standing like statues. They don't turn their heads as they see me ride by. But a little brown
Lovely.
maverick
I've
is
picked one
waiting
myself as well, also from a soundtrack, but it's actually from a video game soundtrack. And it's a video game that would have come out about the same time the book's set, actually. It's called Fable. It's a British video game actually, made somewhere in the UK. And it has a quite lovely soundtrack. It's one of these ones that's good enough to just probably sit down and listen and stick on while you're working.
Thank you.
So it's set in a sort of medievalish magical fantasy world, and it's when it's burned enough into my head that if I listen to it, I sort of go back to being 12 or whatever. But there's one or two tracks in it that are very sort of peaceful but quite playful, sort of, I don't know what you call it. It sounds like the soundtrack for a village, like in the start of one of these sorts of fantasy stories where all is well, or is it? There's like a little hint that something is a little bit scary or off, like you're walking through the woods or something. And I don't know why it came to me when I was trying to think of a song for this book, but I felt that like the pictures of village life we get in Cherries are often quite whimsical. They're not fantastical. Well, as I say, they're not fantastical, but then you do get mad things like a wolf being bred, attack squadrons of geese, brawls in a field. So there is a sort of quirk, that's the word I'm looking for, quirky. There's a quirkiness in the track that is there in the novel, and I think that's why it came to me. And it's just a beautiful soundtrack, so I would direct listeners to go check it out.
That's what I'll listen to next time I'm looking through the book.
Lovely. Oh, and I don't usually link to these, so listeners, if you want to get the exact track I'm on about, it's the one called Witchwood, although there are a couple others near the start of the game, before everything's going pear-shaped, the music gets a bit darker, that would be a fit. So that's that one. I've never seen the film Oklahoma, by the way. Is that of a piece with this novel, or is that too out there?
I'm not sure. I think it has some similarities.
All right. Probably no one-child policy, though.
No.
Okay. The next miscellaneous question is the bonus question. So this is the one that I strip out and I stick up on the show's Patreon. So listeners, you'll hear me ask the question and then you will hear... And if you want to hear Dave's answer, it's up on the Patreon, which will be linked in the show notes. So, Dave, the question's this. To some extent, this is a story about local government and even democracy in some ways. Do you think local governors everywhere could relate to the struggles and situations within? So for all the councillors out there, should we be handing out copies? Okay, there's one more thing I want to hit on. I just made an incorrect recollection about this book. I had it in my head that there's a character who is, he has like a secret room where he's collecting old like books of communist ideology, and he has posters of like Marx, Mao, Stalin, Lenin, Mao on his wall. I think that's not from this one. I'm pretty sure that's from a Yan Lian Ker book. But that does lead me to something I do want to talk about, which is the where the Marxist ideology in this government is, because I believe even today, the government of China, the Communist Party, has all these arms and legs, like party schools. You're supposed to learn your ideology. The ideology is Marxism. But how much of a bearing it actually has on anything they do is ambiguous, shall we say. I was flicking through this book to restore my memories a little bit before the interview, and I noticed Mao, I don't know if it was a coincidence, but like Mao's name came up, Chairman Mao, that is, his name popped up quite a few times. There was a bit about like the importance of doing quote marks ideological work, whatever that is. But at the time of this book, we're in 2003, the economy's become like what, hybrid market socialist system. I don't really remember there being much about collective ownership or anything in the book, but the buzzword seemed to come up a lot. That's my memory. So like, would you have anything to say about how all the sort of legacy of more old school communism, even if it's just the iconography or the figures, the people like Mao, how does that factor into this book about like the sort of minor concerns of local government?
I would say, well, Marx specifically is dealt with quite lightly. Like the character who is the most diehard Marx fan is kind of a figure of fun. If the teacher, teacher Shang Yin, who is determined to put into this village quiz. Like Fan Hua says, can you run a quiz for everyone? Get everyone together. We'll use it as a pretext to like give people some free soap and stuff to, you know, make them happy. And he's like, can we put in some Marx questions? And she says, you know, maybe we don't need to do Marx again this time. And he's like, can we just have one question about Marx? And she's like, okay, fine, just one question about Marx. So in that sense, I think, you know, his like dogged enthusiasm for Marx is used as a source of comedy.
And it's just trivia, right? It's like, when was he born and stuff like that.
When was Marx born? And that was another challenge to translate because it's a mnemonic rhyme that works in Chinese, but couldn't find a way to make it work in English. So yeah, in that sense, it's dealt with quite lightly. I mentioned the flashbacks to the Cultural Revolution. They're also, for the most part, dealt with through the lens of comedy. Like I said, when they're deciding who has to burn down the Confucian temple, and you know, they're all sort of mouthing the Maoist catchphrases, but also kind of being satirized for the fact that no one wants to be the actual one who sets fire to the temple. There's this ongoing bit where they're like, oh, I don't have any fuel. I don't have any fuel. I can't set fire to it. Where is the kindling? There's no kindling. And this protracted attempt to put off actually doing the thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It all felt like window dressing to me, really. Like the names come up. We have the quiz on Marx, but all the policies, like there's nothing really Marxist about a one child policy, apart from maybe like having a powerful government. That's it, really. And again, where a village election fits into a Marxist system of government, I don't think that tracks easily either. I guess to me, it added another sort of layer of absurdity. But then also, I guess all these characters, in a less absurd way, like you were saying, they're of a sort of age where they will have lived through the Cultural Revolution, and they're perhaps fortunate enough to be living in less tumultuous times, where the question is like, who's going to win the election, not who's going to be bullied to death or something.
Right. And Fan Hua has her position of power in the local village council, but she's also contrasted against her sister, who's made a more advantageous marriage and, you know, works in the local township and is richer than her. And so in that respect is doing better than Fan Hua, at least in the eyes of her parents, because she's married well, she has some wealth, she can afford to send them nice cigarettes and do things that Fan Hua can't. So wealth is more important than ideology, I guess, in that respect.
Yeah, and I guess inequalities are creeping in, because as I understand it, in the Mao era, I guess, yes, government officials could be rich and powerful, but like across society, you wouldn't have the vast gulfs of difference in poverty and wealth that you have now. So who knows, maybe advance the story 10 years and that sister is even more wealthy than Fan Hua than she was before or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. I'd love to keep going down this thread, but instead I'll take us to like the final questions, further reading questions. You already mentioned a few other possible things listeners could go looking for, but if listeners want more like cherries on a pomegranate tree, where would you direct them to?
Yeah, I have a few recommendations. If people would like to read a similar kind of story, then Throg by Mo Yan is also about a protagonist who is responsible for implementing the one child policy and carrying out abortions. So she's not doing the same job as Fan Hua, but she's in a similar kind of position. So I think that's one potential novel that you could read alongside this one. For a book that has a similar rural setting, I would recommend The Sacred Clan by Liang Hong, which came out this year, translated by Esther Tilsley. That's a collection of linked short stories that is also set in a small town or a village in the countryside. For the sort of style and voice of Liar, I would recommend Shuang Shue Tao and Rouge Street, which came out last year, I think. That's a collection of three novellas translated by Jeremy Tian. And it's not set so much in the village. It's more sort of small town China, or, you know, industrial China. But I think he has some of the sort of vividness and the liveliness and the energy that Liar also has. And it's also a good opportunity to read novellas, which are, I think, a more popular literary form in Chinese than in English. There's more scope for the publication of novellas in China than there is in other countries, especially in translation. So it's nice to get a volume of novellas. They're definitely worth checking out. And to learn more about sort of being a woman in China and the position of Fan Hua, I would suggest the nonfiction book, Leftover Women, by Leighton Hong Fincher. I think that's an excellent book to read to learn more about the system that Fan Hua exists in and the cultural factors that affect her as a woman in rural China.
Excellent. I think you've knocked it out of the park there. I feel obliged to throw in one more. So this book, Cherries, is published by Sinos Books. So is that one, The Sacred Clan, you mentioned. It's not quite the same, but there's one we covered previously on the show called Graft. I feel like that is a different view of the small town or countryside, rural China. But then I guess it's set in a similar time, and you have the fusion of business and politics, which you don't get so much here. It's more just about local affairs. But I feel like it's blacker humor in Graft, but like some of the absurdity is there as well. So that's my rec. Anyway, very, 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 very final questions now for you, Dave. Are you working on anything just now that you want to, or have you got any, aside from your homepage, is there anywhere that you want to point listeners to your own stuff?
I'm not working on anything directly at the moment. I'm more in a reading mode at the moment. But I did recently translate a couple of extracts by Wei An, some nonfiction nature writing for Spittoon, for the latest issue of Spittoon, which is available in print, but I think not on their website yet. And I translated an essay by Yu Youyou for a forthcoming anthology of essays about poetry from the Poetry Translation Center. So those are two things that will be available soon. But yeah, everything that I do, I put a link to on my blog, which is spittingdog.net.
Spittingdog.net. Okay, that's in my notes now. Okay, that's all my questions. Is there anything at all we've missed you want to say, or are we Gucci?
I think we covered everything.
Cool. Well, in that case, thank you very much for your time, Dave. It was a pleasure. It zipped by, to be honest.
It did.
Okay, we've reached the end of the show. So another big thank you to Dave Haysom, obviously. I hope you all enjoyed that one. I hope if this sounded interesting to you, that you go check out the book, Cherries on a Pomegranate Tree, and maybe some of Lee R's other works as well, if you've not checked those out. Not much else to say from me, I think, just the usual. Remember what I said earlier, if you're interested in an end of the podcast party in Manchester, then let me know. You know, if it's like half a dozen people, hell, that would be amazing. If no one's keen, that's okay. It's a small show. It's not the end of the world. Similarly, if you want to, if you've got any sort of thing you want to submit to the mailbag, you can social media message it in, or the email would be thetranslatedchinesefictionpodcast@outlook.com. Pretty stupid of me, really. I should have just made it trchfic@outlook.com, but I didn't. That's my fault. If you want to follow the show on social media, the links are in the show notes, but just I'll rattle them off. My own Twitter is @AngusLikesWords. The show's Instagram is @trchfic, trchfic. There's a Discord. The Discord is quiet, but you're always free to speak there if you want to speak to other listeners. The best thing you can do for the show is to spread the word. I'm doing this in the wrong order. Silly me. If you'd like to support the show materially, then there's a Patreon. New stuff is coming out on there every 2 weeks. About half of it or so is bonus answers to the bonus questions, which admittedly tend to range from like 5 to 15 minutes. The bonus spiels I do, which are little monologues basically, where I talk about a book I've read, those tend to range between 20 to 40 minutes. If you pay just $1 a month minimum, or more if you want, you get access to, there's 100 plus of these things. A lot of them are the longer ones. Trust me, it's not all the little nuggets. And I said last time, I'll say it again. If you just want to if you just want to throw in the minimum once and then download it all, I am okay with that. And if you'd like to support the show until it ends, I'm okay with that too. I am thinking that when we reach episode 100, I'm just going to pause the payments, because obviously there's no show to support. The hosting fees will continue, unless I can rally a clever, cunning way to keep it going. It would probably involve either setting up an RSS feed myself, which I don't trust myself to do, or taking down the RSS feed and hosting the files as individual files, if the show is well and truly sort of archived. Which is fine, but this is all speculation for the future. And in any case, the Patreon payments are going to freeze when episode 100 is done, because I think it would be too naughty to keep them going, even though the hosting fees would, at least for the time being, they would keep going. Okay, I've babbled on a lot in this intro and outro, so without further ado, let's discuss the best thing you can do for the show, which is to tell your friends. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your teacher, tell your political mentor, tell your electorate, and tell the wolf that you're breeding for your community for some reason. On that note, zaijian.